Coming to you from the ancestral territory of the Anishinaabe and the area inhabited by the Mississaugas of the New Credit First Nation, this is Earth Matters. I'm your host, Lawson Hunter. Earth Matters examines the impacts we have on the environment and the natural world around us, seeking solutions, reporting on news and events, presenting positive alternatives, and highlighting the steps others are taking. We hope to inspire you to join the many others who are working to preserve and protect a healthy planet.
What we try to do is talk in terms of listening. And we do know that we all have values that are guiding us as key principles in our lives. We may not always live up to our ideals, but those values matter and they do motivate us and they influence what we believe and what we don't believe.
I'm speaking with Dr. Louise Comeau, Research Associate with the University of New Brunswick. Welcome to the program. You've been doing some research on how to communicate climate change and carbon pricing. So can you give us an idea of some of the findings that you've come across?
Absolutely. The research we've been doing on, I'll start with carbon pricing, partly because it's topical and a contentious issue. We've been researching how to communicate carbon pricing for about 5 years. And we find some pretty consistent results no matter which way we ask the questions. And that is people evaluate a carbon price on a number of dimensions, a couple of important ones. One being, is it fair? Is it fair to me? Is it fair to me relative to big polluters? Is it fair to me relative to what governments should be doing? So there's an important sense of proportionality that people consider when thinking about these kinds of things. The other thing about carbon pricing they want to know is, does it work? And if they can be convinced that it's unfair to them personally and that it isn't all that effective, then support for carbon pricing can actually be reduced in the face of those kinds of narratives. And those narratives won't be surprising to you. We hear them every day from carbon pricing opponents. However, we've learned through experimental research that we can inoculate people against those opponent messages by emphasizing the fairness dimensions, but also polluter pay dimensions, so you can see the actual opposite, and by opening the narrative with, essentially a tip-off to what opponents are doing, what their motivation is, or how their argument isn't necessarily an accurate or reflective of the actual policy itself. So we know that we can neutralize those negative arguments. It takes work, it takes discipline, but it can be done.
Is there a significant divide between the people that believe in human-induced climate change and those that are, for lack of a better term, climate change deniers? Is there a really distinctive difference between the two?
Absolutely. And we have decades of research showing that your political ideology has a significant influence on how you interpret the same set of facts on climate change. And the strength of your identification, your association with, say, your political tribe, if you're a very strongly identified as a conservative or very strongly identified as a liberal, you're interpreting the very same information in completely different ways. And people aren't climate change experts themselves. They look to their friends, their colleagues, the people that they're loyal to, that they feel identification with, for guidance on how they should react. And we know, for example, from research just out not that long ago, a few weeks ago, that showed people take a cue from social media comments to decide whether they think there's a consensus on the issue or not. So very much the case that our political worldview has an enormous influence on how we interpret climate change.
Mm-hmm. And tell us some of the things, if we're trying to convince our neighbors that things need to be improved, what are some of the choice of words that we should avoid, and what are some of the choice of words that we should use?
Well, one of the things we should stop saying is convince. We can't convince people. We don't succeed by having them feel like they're being treated as if they are stupid in some way. That's always a very difficult entry into a positive conversation. So we try not to talk in terms of convincing. What we try to do is talk in terms of listening. And we do know that we all have values that are guiding us as key principles in our lives. We may not always live up to our ideals, but those values matter, and they do motivate us, and they influence what we believe and what we don't believe. And so the question with communicating to people on the center right, people less, you know, on the extreme right or the extreme left, those people are well entrenched in their positions. But people who are more center left, center right, who are not yet very heavily opinionated, the entry point is through people's values. What is it that people care about? And interestingly, we do have very different values depending on your worldview, particularly your political worldview. So we know, for example, that people who are more conservative in their orientation, and in that I mean, small c, just conservative in their orientation, have certain attributes, certain character traits that go with that orientation. They include respect for authority, a higher sensitivity to purity issues. So, for example, much more responsive to concerns about pollution in water, pollution in air, pollution in food, toxic chemicals, than they are about climate change, which triggers a value that they don't hold for many more conservatively oriented people, and that is this local versus global orientation. More progressive, or people who are comfortable with change, who see themselves as, you know, members of the human race more globally as opposed to more locally, are more comfortable talking about international agreements, the United Nations, global cooperation, more comfortable with change overall, something that a conservative person is less comfortable with. They're more comfortable with tradition, loyalty. As a result of that, we end up essentially talking past each other if you're entering a conversation through your own values, if you happen to be a left-leaning person. So when talking to conservatives, it's a question of what matters to them. If they are talking about concerns about their freedom, then enter the conversation that way. If they feel that climate change interferes with their freedom, you know, we've found that solar energy, for example, solar rooftop is something as a technology that conservatives are comfortable with because it gives them freedom and independence. It reduces their expenditures. If there's one thing a conservative doesn't like is waste. And they are very conserving in that way. It's a real, you know, it's a real thing. You think about it in its fullest sense of the term and the word and the concepts. And so showing them how to cut waste, how to improve and build on tradition. So in the case of environmental protection, often a more liberal-leaning person will, you know, emphasize the newness of things. Conservatives are not really keen on the newness of things. They're more interested in messages. They react much better to messages that talk about preserving, restoring nature to what it was when we were kids, or that we, you know, remember that our parents talked about. That kind of protection and restoration is much more comfortable for a conservative, whereas a more liberal-oriented person will be all excited about new technologies, you know, maybe expanding conservation areas and so on, but misses the mark in terms of protection and going back or holding on to tradition.
Did you find any other divisions, for example, between young and old, rural versus urban, or even gender?
Gender is an important metric. We see it, and it's decades old research, that women have higher sensitivity to risk. They're far more concerned about environmental issues than men are, and far more willing to see strong action on an issue like climate change. one of the challenges that we face is, in my opinion, that we have a ready, willing, and able audience, and very few climate messages are targeted to women. It's an area of research that I'm actually just beginning to undertake right now. In terms of age, it's very interesting. I just was looking at a new set of data that came out of Field last week, and what we see there is that younger people are much more despondent about environmental issues, feel more powerless than older Canadians. They feel that what they might do will have a little impact or maybe a waste of time. Yet when you get right down to measuring specific behaviors, younger people are much more active than older people. So older people talk a good talk, but aren't necessarily walking the walk. And there may be some opportunities there, I think, to bring together the concerns and feelings that grandparents have, for example, with the activism and behaviors that young people, their grandchildren, want to engage in and partner up to some degree. In terms of income, I just want to mention a few things. Education is another one, but on income, the more money you make, interestingly, the more selfish one becomes. And it was a surprise when I first saw that in my data. But it is the case that the more money you make, the more you consume. And in fact, one of the key metrics for transitioning from a low carbon impact to a high carbon impact is income over $60,000 or so. And the behavior that enters into the mix is flying. And flying is a highly polluting activity. Flying for holidays is something that, from a climate change perspective, flying for business, flying at all, should really be minimized. Education is also a factor. It's not that you always see significant differences, but there is a pattern where university-educated, college-educated people can be more, at least factually knowledgeable about climate change issues, environmental issues, more supportive of policy, particularly things like carbon pricing. But you shouldn't, you know, go overboard on that. We see some good results in the sense of people with less education on lower incomes being very supportive of environmental policies, especially that protect their health and help them save money.
And what about rural versus urban?
Well, you do see some differences, but in fact, the study I'm just completing coming out of Field with now is actually looking at this in a pretty interesting way. We're looking at whether there are differences between living in urban and rural environments today versus whether you grew up in urban and rural environment, to see what influences of those potentially two by two, if you think of it in a chart, will have on our results. You know, rural communities can be more opposed to policies, have more concerns about financial side of things, but on a ecological footprint point of view, can, you know, while some will perceive that they drive more, it's not necessarily that their ecological footprint is higher. They may grow food more, they may hunt, they may self-provision in some way. They may drive, but like, you know, may drive for holidays as opposed to flying, and so on. They also have skills that urban people may or may not have, and can feel more confident about their ability to cope, for example, with an extreme event, that kind of thing.
Now, you're based in New Brunswick, the east coast of Canada. The last 4 or 5 years have been pretty hard weather event-wise. There was an ice storm, and then 2 years in a row, there were 100-year record flooding going on. So tell me a little bit about your study on community capacity. You've got a quote in one of your presentations: community capacity is the ability to get things done. How are we set up to deal with these one-time called emergencies? Now they seem to be more common. How are we dealing with that?
Exactly. We have yet to really transition from emergency response to longer-term planning for preparedness and prevention. We know that there are differences in this case. When I looked at post-tropical storm Arthur, there were differences in rural-urban. When I looked at Fredericton and a small community outside of Fredericton called Keswick Ridge, And what we found there was that people had more skills in the rural environments, as I've mentioned, and had to have them. And it's a good thing they had them. They happened to have some equipment because we were rural, low population based. No one came to check on us for 10 days. So people had no power for at least 10 days, as opposed to the urban environments, which were responded to more quickly. Urban people, I have found as well, were really risk ignorant. There's something that I learned about at that time called disaster tourism, and we've been hearing about it again with the recent floods, that people were driving around to see the mess and the drama, and were in the way of first responders, in the way of trucks and such that needed to get to places to drop loads of sand for sandbagging and so on. And so the whole idea of understanding risk and responding appropriately is something that we are not yet fully engaged on. Some people will think about 72-hour preparedness. All of the events that you've mentioned, the ice storm, post-tropical storm Arthur, the floods, have all had power outages associated with them in excess of a week to 2 weeks. And so 72-hour preparedness doesn't even come close to what's required.
Well, you've introduced a couple of concepts to me that I really hadn't thought about before, disaster tourism and risk ignorant. And when you think about it, you know, people are going to, do that, see how bad the other person is, instead of getting out of the car and helping build some sandbags. Tell me how much people rely on the government to solve the problem, both mitigation and adaptation.
This is an important social conversation that we need to have. We have, over the last, several decades, since maybe, post-World War II, developed this perception that, and we've externalized a lot of the things we used to do ourselves to government programs. We believe governments should be intervening. In years gone by, we would have extended families living together. Now our parents or grandparents are in old age homes, for example. And as a result, there is this expectation that my power will work all of the time. Some of the comments I received from people when I interviewed them around Hurricane Arthur was, that they were, essentially entitled to service. They paid for it. And how dare NB Power not be able to provide? We've come to expect things that one really can't continue to expect under a climate change reality that is not being responded well enough to and will get worse. And in a small province like New Brunswick with, just under 760,000 people, we simply don't have the financial resources to pay for the full value of a home, for example, if we're buying people out. The cost of relocation and setbacks, raising houses, all of these things are required. And there's a relationship that has to evolve here that balances more appropriately personal responsibility and accountability with reasonable social support.
One of the comments that you had or from people responding to your survey, churches get things done. And I mean, that talks to the sense of community that you were mentioning. But there was also comments such as it was short-lived and people tend to forget. So you would think that if my house got flooded twice in 2 years, I'd be a bit more sensitive to climate change. Do we have short-term memory when it comes to this?
We have, I'll be very interested to analyze my new data around whether or not the year-on-year events are changing that perspective. There's a few things that interfere with our understanding. One is that people don't understand probability. And so when somebody says to you, this was a 1 in 100 event storm, 100-year event storm, they don't understand that that means that every year there's a 1% chance of an event like that occurring. what we're doing with climate change is reducing those time periods from 1 in 100 years to 1 in 15 years. We're reducing the major events that we might think we'll experience only occasionally to much more frequent events that are also more intense. We know that water volume itself is also increasing when these events occur. So we do think that people are paying much more attention now. The concern I have, and something we are hearing a lot more about, is the health effects of these events. One might perceive that it's primarily a physical health effect, but it's not. It's a mental health effect. And what we're seeing is ongoing anxiety and post-traumatic stress in people after these events. And if they are occurring, as they have in the last 2 years, on an ongoing basis, people don't have a chance to recover. And so we are seeing this year more discussion of people abandoning their locations on the understanding that flood risk is something that's not going to go away. The other factor, of course, is that insurance companies are doubling, tripling their premiums or just not insuring at all. And again, when you come back to what governments can and cannot do, some very hard and heartbreaking decisions are being made and will continue to have to be made.
Mm-hmm. So this has been very interesting research that you've been doing, both on the how to discuss the climate change narrative and also looking at community capacity. How can listeners find out a bit more? Where should they turn to for more research or background?
So I'd suggest a few sources. They can always go to my own website, louise27comeau.ca. But you can also look at Climate Outreach website. They're an organization out of the UK, have done extensive work on climate change and especially around speaking to conservatives. But you can also look at some of the links that I'll send along to you so that your listeners can access those. It's an exploding field, both climate change communications, the health effects of climate change, and talking to conservatives. A quick Google will just have you spending hours at a time reading very interesting material.
All right. Thank you very much for all that you've been doing. I've been speaking with Louise Comeau, the research associate at University of New Brunswick. Thank you very much for joining us on Earth Matters.
Thank you.
The Guide to Communicating Carbon Pricing was prepared for the Partnership for Market Readiness and Carbon Pricing Leadership Coalition. Lead authors included George Marshall from Climate Outreach and Dr. Louise Comeau. Effective communications are integral to designing and implementing a carbon price. They provide means for building acceptance internally across government and externally with key stakeholders and a wider public. This shared understanding and acceptance is essential for building a robust policy that can be sustained through electoral and economic cycles. People are more likely to accept a carbon price when the revenues from it are spent on projects that are consistent with environmental goals, are of high public concern, or are returned to the public as rebates or tax breaks. In some jurisdictions, the visible application of the revenue should be the dominant narrative, ahead of the complex arguments around market mechanisms. Carbon pricing communications should explain how the policy benefits different audiences in ways that are relevant to their real motivations, values, and concerns. These values are very different from the cost-benefit calculations that form a basis of economic assessments. Audience research can be used to analyze those wider values and concerns in order to inform policy formation and communications from the outset. Experience shows that the response to carbon pricing is often a reflection of wider issues of trust in government and business and their perceived accountability. If trust in the government is low, the public may be less likely to trust government explanations of carbon pricing policy. Conducting research is essential for understanding attitudes, identifying the grounds for support and opposition, and selecting the best messages and communicators. Research techniques include surveys for analyzing attitudes across the whole population, focus groups for understanding motivations, and stakeholder engagement to both listen to and inform key constituencies. Testing strategies, narratives, and communication materials with target audiences before they are used helps to gauge reactions and avoid generating a backlash. Communication should be a two-way process that involves not only informing and persuading, but also listening and inviting feedback and advice. Stakeholder engagement, in other words, is inseparable from the design and application of communications. Consultation with stakeholders can help design the policy as well as refine and test the core narratives. Listening to a wide range of stakeholders, including civil society organizations and critical voices, will strengthen the policy and inform communicators about the grounds on which it is likely to be challenged. In some jurisdictions, climate change is considered to be a serious and immediate threat. In others, the issue is politically polarized or not well understood. In the latter case, it is better to lead with other more immediate concerns, for example, issues of local pollution and jobs. Negative threat messaging has failed in many contexts, and the more effective narratives often focus on the positive opportunities of action rather than the negative consequences of inaction. Three sources for further information, as outlined by Dr. Como, are the Proceedings of National Academy and Sciences of the United States of America, Journal. Discussing Global Warming Leads to Greater Acceptance of Climate Science. Science by Social Media, Attitudes Towards Climate Change Are Mediated by Perceived Social Consensus, found on the Springer Journal website. Another source of information can be found on the Climate Outreach website under Resource, Type, and Center Right. Lawson Hunter here, host and producer of Earth Matters. I wanted to thank all the listeners of Earth Matters for your continuing support. As always, please feel free to send us your comments, suggestions, and thoughts on topics and people we should look at for future programs. I'd also like to encourage you to like, rate, and share Earth Matters with others so that our work can reach a larger audience. Thanks for listening.